Handley.
Thank you very much indeed, Jonathan. Hello and welcome to a packed Royal Albert Hall for a BBC prom consisting of three symphonies written by the same composer over something like a 15-year period. Vaughan Williams, 4th, 5th and 6th, couldn't be much more different from one another. And for tonight's conductor of the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra, Andrew Manzi, they demonstrate the range of a great symphonist he considers to be still underrated.
A man of great warmth, also corners of himself that are troubled. On paper, his life looks very good. In reality, he maybe has his doubts all along. And you hear this. You hear anger sometimes, frustration. You're not quite sure why, what he's frustrated at, but it's definitely there.
Vaughan Williams' first three symphonies had titles. The fourth is simply in F minor. And as far as the composer was concerned, that's what it was about, which hasn't stopped listeners trying to work out something more concrete since the first performance in 1935. It's been called a prediction of the Second World War or a summing up of the increasingly dangerous state of Europe at the time. VW had experienced the First War himself and hated the concept of war just as he hated the military establishment. Whatever else it is, though, the ferocious, boisterous Fourth is surely not a plea for peace. Vaughan Williams did tell friends he began work on the symphony in 1931 after reading an article in the Times about a festival of contemporary music. In it, H.C. Collis wrote that modern symphonies all relied on the same order of stimuli. The hearer is prodded into activity by dissonance, soothed by sentiment, overwhelmed by the power of a battering climax. The appeal is primarily sensuous, even though the composer makes play with formal processes of thematic development. Perhaps there is no new principle to be discovered, and the only thing to do is make good music on an old principle. VW seems to have decided that was just what Beethoven had done in his Fifth Symphony, whose grand plan he emulates in a work which seems to fall in exactly with Collis's remarks. Add to that the self-portrait element, which some of VW's friends felt they recognised, his outbursts of temper, his humour and ribaldry, and you can begin to understand why Vaughan Williams said at rehearsals for the first performance, "I don't know if I like it, but it's what I meant." Well, a packed auditorium and a pretty packed platform for Vaughan Williams 4. And here comes the guest leader of the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra, Lucy Gould. Followed onto the platform here in the Royal Albert Hall by Andrew Manzi to conduct Vaughan Williams' Fourth Symphony.
Thank you.
Thank you.
return of those harsh, grinding dissonances from the opening of the symphony slammed in our faces before that final massive thud. Vaughan Williams' Fourth Symphony, performed here in the Royal Albert Hall to open tonight's BBC Prom, live, of course, on Radio 3, home of the Proms, by the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Andrew Manzi. What a concise, personal piece it is, but surely bearing the imprint of the troubled times during which VW wrote it. He was asked by one friend why there was no beauty in the symphony. Was it because of the political upheaval and unease? Vaughan Williams replied he did think it beautiful. He didn't mean it to be a reflection of unbeautiful times, not a definite picture of anything external, but simply because that's how it occurred to him. The first performance was greeted with huge applause, as is tonight's. Rosemary Elliott, the principal flautist, being brought to her feet, chosen specially for singling out by Andrew Manzi. I have to say, he conducts as a violinist you would think would and should very much, with the strings always at the front of his mind. Very precise at rehearsal, rather more involved tonight. Well, as with all his symphonies to this point, Vaughan Williams' Fifth took him some years to complete. He was over 70 when he did so, and he dedicated it to Sibelius. I asked Andrew Manzi why he thought Vaughan Williams chose this symphony.
My own personal sort of private theory that I wouldn't share with anyone is that he had the thought that the Fifth was his last symphony, and that he was making a statement, somehow rounding off something, and that dedicating it to Sibelius was a way of almost trying to make his position clear, that he felt he was an English Sibelius. That's why.
Well, the Fifth turned out to be far from a summation. What it is, though, is a landmark piece for his work during the Second World War, and the epitome of his contemplative side, his lyrical, almost religious response to the times, couched in music which could trace its ancestry back to the great Tudor choral tradition. That response is made clearer by the fact that when he began writing the symphony, Vaughan Williams had abandoned, for a time at least, his opera based on The Pilgrim's Progress, and he used several themes from it in the Fifth. It's not just themes, though. The basic nature of the symphony grows from the vision of the celestial city, which is the object of the character Christian's journey in the opera. So the predominant emotion in the Fifth is complete opposition to the violence of the Fourth. We've just heard here in the Royal Albert Hall is, as Frank Howes says in his biography of Vaughan Williams, peace. Ultimate and fundamental peace, not the mere absence of armed conflict. It describes the nature of the true peace in the hearts of those who, like Christian in The Pilgrim's Progress, have faced their conflicts and come through them. Of the four movements, the scherzo, which is played second, is the only one to have no connection with The Pilgrim's Progress, and it's Vaughan Williams' most elusive and impressionistic orchestral scherzo. The following slow movement is the heart of the work, originally headed by this quotation: "Upon that place there stood a cross, and a little below a sepulchre. Then he said, he hath given me rest by his sorrow and life by his death." And here once more comes Andrew Manzi, joining the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra on the Royal Albert Hall platform to perform Vaughan Williams' Fifth Symphony. Perfect piece, you might say, at the end of Vaughan Williams' Fifth Symphony, a transcendental symphonic journey through The Pilgrim's Progress, the opera which he was in the middle of writing at the time, performed here in the Royal Albert Hall as the second BW Symphony in tonight's BBC Prom by the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra under its associate guest conductor and great BW advocate Andrew Manzi. First thing he did was to bring the principal horn, David Flack, to his feet. Well, if the fifth is a return to Vaughan Williams' pastoral mood, the evocative music's made stronger by the way it's shaped in such a subtly thought-out symphonic argument. The result, you have to think, of the tautly structured fourth. And there was a rather wicked thought in Andrew Manzi's mind at one point that he was going to segue, go straight from the fourth into the fifth without any break. He did kind of think the orchestra might string him up somewhere, so he didn't do it. But they do make extraordinary, contrasting companion pieces. Back on the platform, Andrew Manzi. The first performance of the symphony was conducted by Vaughan Williams himself during the 1943 prom season in this building, and I suspect he was standing on the same podium with the half-moon brass rail on which Andrew Manzi is now standing and taking the applause of the house. Luminous music, isn't it? Like stained glass windows. Except that quixotic fleeting scherzo with those echoes of Ravel's in those elusive dabs of colour. A reminder that Vaughan Williams studied with Ravel, of course. Back once again. Tonight's conductor, Andrew Manzi, bringing the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra to its feet. And the opera which was so influential on that music, The Pilgrim's Progress, gets a new production this November at English National Opera. Well, that symphony may mark the end, in a way, of the first stage of Vaughan Williams' symphonic journey, but it has a newfound sense of purpose, which continues in the sixth, which, albeit in music surrounded by a sense of spiritual desolation, we'll be hearing after the interval here in the Royal Albert Hall. And on Radio 3, we turn from music to words, but stay with Vaughan Williams as we head down the steps to the Royal College of Music to join Rana Mitter.
Tonight, I'm talking to the composer Anthony Payne, who has a deep affinity with the English classical tradition. Witness his temporary inhabitation of the shade of Edward Elgar in completing his Third Symphony. And so Anthony Payne is a perfect person to explore the character and work of another of its towering figures, Ralph Vaughan Williams. Vaughan Williams' Fourth, Fifth and Sixth Symphonies are, of course, featuring in tonight's prom, but there's a lot more to him than just an elderly English gent who loved the countryside. He comes across as a forthright personality in his letters and also in the accounts of those who knew him well, such as his second wife, Ursula Wood. So, Tony, I was wondering, why doesn't Vaughan Williams seem to command as much attention today as, say, Elgar or Britten?
I think he suffered, like a lot of composers who were extremely highly thought of at the point that he died. He went through a period when he was ignored a bit, and there was a new generation of young critics with whom I did not align, who ran him down at the expense of, well, the new moderns and say, Benjamin Britten. And I've always felt that you don't have to run someone down in order to espouse the cause of another. You ought to espouse both causes. But I think he was just a victim of the passing of time. And now, to judge by the returns that one gets from performing rights from his works, he's being performed all over the place. And, I mean, we have three, four complete sets of the symphonies recorded. So I don't think he's being neglected, but he still is being misunderstood by some, actually.
Yes, I mean, perhaps to be a bit provocative, is it still perhaps a little bit less respectable, a bit more gauche to say you're a lover of Vaughan Williams than, say, a lover of Britten? Or is that not so much the case anymore?
No, I don't think it is. When I came down from university to London, loving all that English turn of the century music you were talking about, and also the moderns, I didn't dare speak about them. I would have been looked at as someone who crawled out from under a stone if I spoke about Elgar, Vaughan Williams, Delius. One spoke about Messiaen, Varèse, Boulez, Stockhausen, Ligeti. But I love those too.
Of course, the two are not incompatible with each other, and if one's crawling from under a stone, at least perhaps it's traditional Cotswold stone in that particular particular case. Vaughan Williams is associated with a particular sort of Englishness, and certainly he identified himself as an English composer. But perhaps
yes.
his idea of England was one that went in and out of fashion through the
yes,
course of
I
the century.
Yes, I think that's possibly true. I mean, for all his Englishness, he was stylistically a cosmopolitan, just as Elgar was. And I'm always being asked the question, as you can imagine, what is it that's so English about Elgar? And the answer is, I don't know. And I know what's English about Vaughan Williams because he does have that relationship to the folk song movement, and of course a strong relationship to English Tudor music. But Elgar didn't have that. He had a strong relationship to German and French music, so what's English about that? And Vaughan Williams found himself when he learned, I think, how to relate that Englishness to Ravel, Debussy, etc. So there's that double-sidedness.
Well, we can get a very strong sense of Vaughan Williams' sense of his own Englishness, actually, from a letter that he wrote when he was just in his 20s to his cousin, Ralph Wedgwood. And I'm delighted to give us the readings this evening. We have the actor Dominic Rowan with us. Dominic.
Tuesday. I haven't yet told you about Lymington. I always imagined that Lymington was a small and unpleasant watering place, but is in reality a delightful and very sleepy little town which happens to be by the Solent and to look across to the Isle of Wight. Here comes in another of my delusions. I always imagined that the Isle of Wight was a gimcracky kind of a place, but what we saw of it was a magnificent stretch of downs and white cliffs. Don't think me degenerate in my likes, but you know, I have always preferred soft scenery to stern, uncomfortable scenery. I can admire it, but I can't really enjoy it. I know that shows a craven spirit, but I can't help it. My heart goes through the same maneuvers as Wordsworth's when he saw a rainbow, when I see a long, low range of hills. I suppose this comes from being born in Surrey, S.W.
The thing that struck me about this passage was that there's a sort of confession there, really, from Vaughan Williams, that he prefers perhaps the homely to the sublime. And there's also a bit of a leg pull, because he says he's born in Surrey, but actually, of course, he was born in Gloucestershire, in Downampney.
Mm. Yes, but and also remember that was written when he was still quite young. But there was no doubt that, interestingly, that he liked cityscapes more they meant almost more to him than countryscapes. There was the famous time when he went to America and saw Niagara Falls and the skyscrapers of New York, and found them more intriguing and more tremendous, man-made things, than that he found Niagara Falls. I mean, Vaughan Williams is full of contradictions, actually. That's the thing.
Well, of course, two of the symphonies that we're not hearing tonight, but of course remain amongst the best known, one is on London and one is on Antarctica. You can't really get further away than those.
Absolutely. I mean, his symphonies as a whole, they cover an amazing ground spiritually and emotionally. I remember thinking once when reading about the famous meeting between Mahler and Sibelius, when Sibelius spoke of the internal logic and purity of thought in the symphony, and Mahler said, oh, no, nothing like that. It must encompass the whole world, said Mahler. And my goodness, it does. Now, Vaughan Williams could actually write both types of symphony, so he could encompass the Mahlerian and the Sibelian. You can say that London Symphony is a Mahlerian kind of a work because it includes popular things. It also includes vulgarity, functional vulgarity, and irony, and symphonies number 3, say the partial, and number 5 are absolutely pure, and the 6th symphony, which we'll hear tonight, belongs to the sort of Mahlerian kind of symphony, although it's a mixture by then of these two things. But he has an enormous scope.
Do you think Vaughan Williams would have or did ever say that about himself? You know, that kind of wonderfully grandiloquent statement that it must contain the whole world. One sort of slightly imagines him shying away from something that sort of grandstanding.
Vaughan Williams would never have said anything like that. I wouldn't say self-doubting, but he was very modest about himself, the fact that he would go and take advice about how he should orchestrate a certain passage. And this has been held against him by the smarter critics, who thereby think that he's unprofessional. It's just he was a modest kind of a man.
He was also, of course, in some ways, a rather cussed sort of a man. And one of the letters of his that I was delighted to find, because it completely went against my assumptions about Vaughan Williams, was about his attitude towards politics. A letter that he wrote in 1952 to a fellow composer, Rutland Boughton. And Boughton, I think, was trying to get him to sign some sort of peace manifesto. And the reading says exactly what Vaughan Williams thought about this. Dominic.
When I was a boy at school, I and another boy stood out as radicals, as we were called then, against all the other boys. When I got to Cambridge in 93, I and a few friends read the Fabian Tracts and, in opposition to the majority of undergraduates, became socialists. This was probably before you were born. The truth is, I think that when I am with conservatives, I become socialistic. And when I am with socialists, I become a true blue Tory. Ever since I had the vote, I have voted either Radical or Labour, except once, after the war, when I was so disgusted by what I considered the mean trick of the Labour Party in forcing an election. I voted Labour in the last election, though in my heart of hearts, I wanted the Tories to get in. But the old spirit of opposition crept up, and with all the country shouting for the Tories, I determined to be on the other side. So I assure you, my spirit remains what you call generous. I believe in freedom, and that is why I will not be bullied by Nazis, fascists, or Russians.
I mean, Anthony, should we be surprised to think of him as someone who would have been a Labour or indeed a radical leftist in the mid-20th century?
I'm not sure whether we should, really. I think a lot of people imagine, for instance, that those composers of ours that were writing at the same time as the early volumes will have been conservatives, but they weren't. Most of our great composers were of the left. The only one who wasn't was Elgar, who actually resigned from his club when the first Labour Prime Minister was voted a member of the club. Elgar immediately resigned. And I really detest that viewpoint, actually, I have to say. But, I mean, Delius was a lefty. People might have thought he wasn't, but he was. Holst was, of course. Rutland Boughton, we just mentioned. Vaughan Williams, Holst. They were men of the left.
And if he was perhaps not what we might expect in terms of his politics, he was also nonconformist, you might say, in terms of his household arrangements. At one point, he was living with his wife, Adeline, but also at the same time with a younger woman, Ursula Wood, whom he married later on. And I think this was not public knowledge, but within Vaughan Williams' circle, amongst the musicians and others he knew, was this something that people knew about?
It is known by most people who know about Vaughan Williams, and as I've mixed with, I knew Ursula quite well and things like that. These things were mentioned. Ursula, I must say, on one occasion said, "It's so exciting to be the other woman." I'm not prepared to go any further than that.
Well, that sounds eminently reasonable. And judging by the letters I've seen, actually it did seem to be a rather happy arrangement for all three of them. Adeline did, of course, die, and Vaughan Williams married the widowed Ursula Wood in 1953, although, of course, he was about 40 years older than she was. And they also travelled abroad. They went to Greece, in fact, in 1955. And Ursula gives part of the account of their trip in her biography of Vaughan Williams. Dominic.
Our party was too large for one bus, but not enough for two. So six of us were given a Cadillac, driven by a very tall Greek called Hercules. He took charge of us, and because we could go much faster than the bus, we had all sorts of delightful and unscheduled stops. The first day of sightseeing was impressive. Daphne, where Byzantine mosaics gazed down in mournful splendor, and where, As we stood in the courtyard, a dark-eyed Mercury, loitering with other locals to look at the tourists, came straight through the crowd to us and gave us each a branch of bay leaves. A touching welcome to the world of legend. Mycenae was all we had expected. The Lion Gate, the steep road, and the brooding ruins. It had the same air of menace that is so apparent at Corfe Castle, but being open and no longer dominated by any great building, it was more bearable. Our great moment was when we asked what was the distant hill with what looked like a fortress to the south, and Mr. Cook, the archaeologist who had in charge of us all, said briefly, Argos. The magic of the sea light, the herb-scented air, the stories we had lived with all of our lives had already made their impact. I am glad we are here, Rafe said.
Tony, the biography obviously very much a public document, and something that does come out very clearly from it is the very deep love and affection between the two of them. Do you feel that Ursula was an inspiration for the music?
I think Vaughan Williams was a self-contained visionary person. I mean, obviously outside things made impressions on him, and I'm not sure that those kind of impressions are in any way important to understanding the music. That's the main thing. People get it wrong, for instance, when they say that, and we know this, it's been argued over and over again, that the Fourth Symphony and all its violence is to do with the politicising of the time. But in fact, he started to conceive of that work before the Nazis took over in 1933, and that the Fifth Symphony was a vision of peace in the middle of the war. But the conception was beginning to take shape sometime before the war, and he often himself said that we should not look to outside circumstances but just listen to the music. And I'm not sure whether his relationships with his wife or with Ursula, subsequently wife, did anything more than please and comfort him. I don't know whether they provided inspiration.
Well, actually, that very particular point about whether or not one should read a programme into his music is something that we do have a letter from Vaughan Williams to his friend Robert Longman about, and he is in fact talking exactly about that, about the Fourth Symphony. Dominic.
I spent yesterday in bed nursing a cold, so I decided to try to answer your long and splendid letter of a long time ago. One. I agree with you that all music must have beauty. The problem being, what is beauty? So when you say you do not think my F minor symphony beautiful, my answer must be that I do think it beautiful. Not that I did not mean it to be beautiful because it reflects unbeautiful things, because we know that beauty can come from unbeautiful things, e.g. King Lear, Rembrandt's School of Anatomy, Wagner's Nibelungs, etc. As a matter of fact, one, I am not at all sure that I like it myself now. All I know is that it is what I wanted to do at the time. Two, I wrote it not as a definite picture of anything external, e.g. the state of Europe, but simply because it occurred to me like this. I can't explain why. I don't think that sitting down and thinking about great things ever produces a great work of art. At least I hope not, because I never do so. And when you state your belief in me, dear Bobby, I feel the completest of frauds. A thing just comes. Or it doesn't. Usually doesn't. I always live in hope, as all writers must, that one day I shall ring the bell. In younger days, when one thought one was going to do the real thing each time, and each time discovered one hadn't done it, one said hopefully, next time. But when one touches on 65, one begins to wonder.
So Vaughan Williams himself there warning us against trying to read too literalistically into his music. Mm. But at the same time, I mean, one thinks of other things that influence him. I mean, politics is one thing you mentioned there. But of course, he also visited New York. And people have said sometimes there's a sort of steely quality to the fourth, and one thinks of his description in one of his letters of the Plaza Hotel and the kind of steel skyscraper yes. canyons of New York.
Well, I mean, who can say? Listening to that letter, it's all very well saying him saying things just happen, but then your next question is why? Why did the Fourth Symphony happen at that time? And you really cannot answer that question. He might have got up one morning and all of a sudden thought, I'll do something like that. And he did it. And don't forget also that although it sounds a lot of people felt it was the beginning of a new dissonant modernism in Vaughan Williams, I mean, it's Michael Kennedy who's quite rightly said, actually, it's not the beginning of a new phase in Vaughan Williams at all. It's the ending of an old phase, because we've heard music like that in Sancta Civitas, in the piano concerto, and this was a climactic expression of all that kind of thing. And immediately after, he moved on into other areas and didn't actually follow up on that particular language. It's almost unique in his output. And the fascinating thing is that it's absolutely pure Vaughan Williams from beginning to end. Nobody could have written it but him, and yet there aren't any other pointers back to it from later.
So what does that mean when, as tonight, we hear it as part of a programme of three consecutive symphonies? Because, of course, we're hearing the fourth and then the fifth and then the sixth.
Well, I mean, this is going to be an absolutely fascinating experience because they obviously all tie up together, and you'll see things, little occasions in the Fourth Symphony, which you'll find in the later symphonies, just little links, which mean that they're by the same person. But they live in three different worlds, and this is an incredible thing. I remember at the time of Vaughan Williams' last works, and then around the time of his death, some commentators on his music were daring to mention the name of Beethoven in relationship to Vaughan Williams, and of course immediately afterwards other people thought that this was much too pretentious, fancy comparing Vaughan Williams with Beethoven. But after the years, and I've known these symphonies now for nearly 60 years, I do feel that there's only one other man I know of, I'm not saying that Vaughan Williams is as great as Beethoven, but who actually inhabits totally different worlds in his symphonies, like Beethoven 5, 6, 7, all live in totally different worlds, and they are all obviously by Beethoven. Listen to Vaughan Williams 3, 4, 5, and 6, and each one lives in an utterly different world, and that they're all by the same man. This is a phenomenal achievement, and I think this makes Vaughan Williams one of the truly great composers. And I didn't dare say this about 30 years ago, because people would have laughed at me, but I don't care whether they laugh at me now. He is a truly great composer on the strength, at least, of those four achievements, each one totally different, each one unified by his imagination. They all ring that bell.
I'm afraid that's all we have time for right now, so many thanks to Anthony Payne and to our reader, Dominic Rowan.
Rana Mitter presented that Proms Plus literary event. The producer was Zahid Worley, and Anthony Payne sitting just below me here in the Royal Albert Hall, entranced by the music he's hearing. Welcome back to the hall from me, Martin Handley, and to the second half of this BBC Prom, live, of course, here on Radio 3, home of the Proms. Tonight's orchestra is the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra, and together with its associate guest conductor, Andrew Manzi, they're tackling a trio of Vaughan Williams symphonies, which demonstrate the huge range of his orchestral writing. We began tonight with the brutal fourth, followed by the serenity of the fifth. In the sixth symphony, which we hear now, Vaughan Williams sprang the biggest surprise of his symphonic career. I asked Andrew Manzi what he thinks VW set out to achieve.
He's brave. The thing I think of straight away is that he brings a saxophone into the orchestra. It's like challenging the whole establishment of what an orchestra is and what a symphony is. He brings an instrument from the jazz club. And I think it shows that although he's getting on a bit as a composer, he's really wanting to break new ground. But he doesn't want to show too much. He's quite a private man. But actually, when he's sitting there writing the music, he's showing an awful lot. I just think he doesn't want us to analyse it and put it in words. It's maybe painful enough for him to have exposed it in the symphony.
No, of course. I mean, he was, you know, always against people who were saying that the Fourth was a, you know, the state of Europe in 1935, and that the Sixth was post-war and the atomic apocalypse and so on. But then he did say about, you know, our little life rounded by a sleep, and you can hear something of that in the finale, can't you?
Yes, I definitely think you can. I think he's feeling, after the Second World War is finished, the loss greater than he's feeling the triumph that the war is finished. And that's what the symphony is perhaps is about, is an expression of loss and grief. I do hear post-atomic Holocaust in the finale. He's very cross with me for saying that, but I can't help but hear it. But it still applies in 2012. It still has this power.
Andrew Manzi, well, one new facet of the symphony is that the four movements are linked to form a continuous whole. As Vaughan Williams put it, each of the first three has its tail attached to the head of its neighbour. Symphony was first performed in 1948, was immediately popular, audiences seeming to accept the obvious change of direction in the music from the profound piece of the Fifth. If the Sixth, with its restless, adventurous energy, felt like a negation of that piece, then it also seemed to be an intense affirmation of humanity. Music riddled with tensions, often strident, dissonant, and even more extraordinary when you remember that Vaughan Williams was in his mid-70s at the time he completed it. Well, BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra's ready and waiting on the platform, and they're joined by their associate guest conductor, Andrew Manzi, to perform Vaughan Williams' Sixth Symphony. We are such stuff as dreams are made on, and our little life is rounded with a sleep. Words from Prospero's Farewell in Shakespeare's Tempest, which Vaughan Williams said were the nearest he could get to describing that extraordinary last movement. That seemed to encompass a vast emptiness. The sleep we come from and return to, in which case the other three movements may be life, storms and dramas leading to the final mystery. Vaughan Williams' Sixth Symphony, performed here in the Royal Albert Hall, live on Radio 3, to end tonight's BBC Prom by the Scottish Symphony Orchestra, guest leader Lucy Gould, conducted by Andrew Manzi. And the first thing he did was bring Stella McCracken, principal oboe, to her feet. Again, all sorts of people asking what he meant by the symphony. Vaughan Williams retorted, "I suppose it's never occurred to these people a man might just want to write a piece of music." A war symphony? Well, Andrew Manzi thinks there's something in that. The percussion section of the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra brought to its feet. Vaughan Williams did admit that sinister dance band-like saxophone tune was written in response to the killing of a jazz band leader in a German bombing raid. Up come the trumpets. It's going to be round the orchestra now. They'll want to get home before the John Cage Centenary Mega Spectacular tomorrow, curated and conducted by Ilan Volkov. As for Andrew Manzi, well, he's off his first visit to mostly Mozart in New York before returning to his orchestra in Helsingborg for his first Sibelius II. That applause for the entire woodwind section of the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra, and he only remains to bring the strings to their feet. I asked Andrew Manzi whether he thought Vaughan Williams still underrated as a symphonist, and his reply was, "Not by the people who know the symphonies. The hardest thing is to get people in through the door to listen to them. If they've decided Vaughan Williams' music is old-fashioned, solid and worthy, well, I hope, and I'm sure Andrew does, that as a result of tonight's journey, people revise their image of the composer to someone whose brave humanity bursts out from every page of the three scores we've heard." Certainly they've infused this very large audience here in the Royal Albert Hall. Andrew Manzi coming back into it. But as he does, time for me to hand you on to Jonathan Swain at Broadcasting House to host the rest of your Radio 3 evening. Jonathan.
Martin, thank you. Yes, indeed, a prom to remember. Martin Handley there at the Royal Albert Hall. And ways of hearing that prom again include the iPlayer online for the next 7 days. There'll also be a chance to hear the prom broadcast again here on Radio 3 on Friday, the 31st of August at 2 in the afternoon. As for tomorrow night at the Hall...
Music is everywhere. You just have to have the ears to hear it. The words of John Cage, who was born 100 years ago. The BBC Proms marks Cage's centenary with music played from every corner of the Royal Albert Hall. Ilan Volkov curates and conducts an evening of John Cage at the BBC Proms. Live on Radio 3, tomorrow night, from 7:45.
Well, back to tonight, and in just under 5 minutes, highlights from the BBC Proms Inspire Young Composers Concert. The Aurora Orchestra are performing the winning entries from this year's Proms Inspire Young Composers Competition. And after it, Percy Grainger is in the spotlight. Aspects of Grainger is the subject of the essay this week in the Radio 3 evenings. And tonight, Lucy Parham will be looking at Grainger the pianist, the golden pianist he was sometimes called, and he was even mentioned in the same breath as Horowitz and Rachmaninoff. That's Aspects of Grainger tonight at 10:45. And an aspect of Grainger right now. Molly on the Shore by Percy Grainger, the English Chamber Orchestra there, conducted by Stuart Bedford. And as I say, Grainger, the pianist, is the subject of tonight's The Essay here on Radio 3 at 11:15. It's a little after 10:05, and now BBC Proms Inspire, which took place earlier this month. Here's Andrew McGregor.
Thousands of young musicians have been intimately involved in the BBC Proms for this one extraordinary and extraordinarily busy weekend. We've had youth orchestras from all over the UK playing in the Royal Albert Hall alongside the professionals, youth choirs, and the National Youth Orchestra of Great Britain's annual prom, playing new pieces by Anna Meredith and Nico Mouly alongside Messiaen's immense Tarangalila Symphony. And just across the road, Proms Inspire has invaded the Royal College of Music again this year. Workshops and concerts where budding composers aged 12 to 18 can share ideas, they can experiment with new tools and techniques, they can work with professional musicians and meet other composers. And as part of Proms Inspire over the last few months, hundreds of the students have been sending in their pieces to a judging panel which has picked their favourites. And we're going to hear the three winning pieces performed by members of the Aurora Orchestra and conductor Nicholas Collin. I'll also be catching up with the composers to find out about their music, as well as eavesdropping on the improvisation, graphic notation and electronic workshops that have been in full swing all day. I'm with composer Stephen Montague, who's been running one of the workshops in the Royal College of Music's Parry Rooms today. Graphic scoring, and I saw the billing, Stephen, that is in the little introduction to the Proms Inspire Day, and it described it as extreme sonic adventure. So what are you trying to say to the students here?
Well, I think what this was an attempt to do is to put in the context of where the graphic score is in history. And of course, you know, in the 9th century, there were kind of graphic scores as to how to remember Gregorian chants. So we kind of went through the centuries up to the 20th century and into Earl Brown, December 1952, which is probably the first contemporary graphic score. And it's mostly to sort of loosen up the students to see alternative ways of writing music that can be effective, punchy, and actually deal with a sound world that it still can be exciting.
So a new way of expressing yourself on paper, effectively, isn't it?
Well, it's not a new way. It's an old way that has been forgotten. And, you know, it's kind of interesting to reintroduce some of these old tricks, you know, by an old dog teaching the new kids some new tricks. So I'm just trying to kind of open up their world to some of the things that I learned, expand their experience to something that I think is very valuable in the firmament of music, new music.
Now, Nicky, you've been in Stephen's workshop this afternoon. Were you used to any of these kind of ways of expressing yourself on paper, or is this new to you?
It's reasonably new. I mean, I've seen some types of graphic scores before, but I'd definitely never seen certainly most of the stuff from before the 20th century. Looking at all the monk chants, how they used to notate their music, that's really interesting, and I found it quite strange because I didn't actually know they had to remember so much music. So I can see now why they came up with the notation that they did.
What sort of impact do you feel it could have on you as a composer yourself? Do you feel that it does sort of extend your manuscript vocabulary, if you like, give you new possibilities?
Yeah, definitely, because, you know, Stephen said to us that there's a lot of things that Sibelius can't do, and I think there's a lot of effects and even sounds that you can't actually achieve without some kinds of these. You sort of create your own key in a way, and yeah, you can show people different sort of ways of bringing in and out instruments and that kind of thing that is really difficult to do accurately on paper, usually with normal notation methods.
So there's a new kind of accuracy about the way you're expressing yourself.
Yeah, yeah. I suppose a lot of it is less kind of in the sense of counting and like when does this beat come where, but instead you actually have a visual thing to bring you in or show you where to play which bits. So it definitely helps ensemble skills as well, because it helps everyone listen to each other and you can all work together to listen to what one person is doing and take that and use it when you play your piece.
Now let's hear the first winning piece from the Young Composers Competition. It's called Mirmish. It's by 17-year-old Alex Wolfe. And Alex, it's inspired by W.B. Yeats, a passage of Yeats. So what's the story and how's it become music?
Well, there was just six lines of text that really struck me from this poem by Yeats. And it seems to encapsulate such a strong narrative, and it has a huge emotional breadth in such a small space of time. And for this competition, where our pieces have to be under 5 minutes, it seemed to have the perfect sense of clarity for the piece that I wanted to write.
Now, what's the poem?
The poem is called The Mermaid, I believe, by Yeats, and it's just these six lines from it. It's all about a young lad who's swimming at sea, and the mermaid kind of fixates on him, and they kind of get entangled, and eventually it says she forgets that even lovers drown, and it's just got this little twist at the end, and it's quite poignant and quite beautiful, I thought.
And how have you actually drawn the characters into the score? And what should we listen out for?
Well, it's for bassoon and string quartet, so initially quite an unconventional ensemble. I thought of the string quartet as both the sea and the mermaid, kind of drawing and enticing the bassoonist's young lad, the young swimming lad, in, if you like. And they get intertwined, the cello and the bassoon particularly press into each other with the same note and a semitone apart, and I've tried to capture the sort of both the kind of ecstatic feeling in the poem and the reverse of that.
And why Mirmish, not quite a mermaid?
Mirmish, well, I love the Harry Potter books, and the mermaids in those speak this funny language, which is not necessarily how you expect mermaids to speak, and it's called Mirmish in the Harry Potter books. I thought this might be my interpretation of the language of the mermaids.
Thank you.
A Swimmer Drowned by an Over-Amorous Mermaid. That's Mermish by Alex Wolfe, one of our two junior winners of the BBC Proms Inspire Young Composers Competition. And you'll hear the other one and our senior winner just a little later. Listening to the practical improvisation workshop this afternoon, the subject of which is groove. Now, Jules Buckley, this is your workshop. Define groove. You have 10 seconds.
Well, groove should be anything that's locked into a point that's making people want to move.
Can you teach it? Isn't this just something that people have to feel? It's the old adage.
I think you can totally teach it. Yeah, I mean, if some guy's spent his whole life playing or having a particular penchant for romantic music, and then you play him a James Brown record, then you know there's a good chance. Perhaps initially he might not be so down with the beat, but I'm sure by just explaining what to listen for and how to feel it, I'm sure that everybody can groove, basically. It's just a case of trying to unlock it as fast as possible.
And how have you been doing that with the students you've had today?
Well, we just focused on a few really simple tasks or a few simple riffs, and the main thing was what we call, I guess, in the music world of subdividing and where the emphasis lies, and also upon kind of moving and dancing and putting those things together and working on different exercises, like take one simple riff, if it's not happening immediately, slow it down, effectively like magnifying something in, having a look at it and then get that tight and then speed it up. It's a very simple process, actually. But a lot of classical musicians don't think like that, so it's just not a bad thing. It's just they don't have to do it. Yeah.
Now, Emily, you've been one of Jules' students in the workshop this afternoon. What do you play?
Well, I brought my violin today, but I play a mixture of things, piano, guitar, singing.
And is this kind of workshop familiar to you? Are you somebody who's needs the groove unlocking, if you like, to use what Jules was saying?
It's funny because you said about classical musicians, I find it harder. And I played violin in orchestras before, and you do find that it's harder for syncopation and things like that for them to really grab it. But because I also play in a band and other things like that, it's a bit easier when you know the more kind of popular music sort of thing. It's just easier if you can pick up a beat. It's like some people get it, some people can't. It doesn't mean you can't teach it to them.
And do you find it's easy to actually bring those things across from the band experiences through to classical composition, if you like?
Oh yeah, no, it's really helpful. It means like you can draw things from different areas of music that you're interested in, because I'm interested in pretty much everything. I can draw things from different areas of music and put it into one thing. So say I was composing something that's classical but maybe a little bit more contemporary, I can take something from jazz or take something from rock that might kind of help that to make it a little bit more quirky. So that's basically what we're dealing with today. So we've got a lot of classical musicians coming, and a lot of the pieces they compose are quite contemporary, but in the kind of improvisational thing we did with Jules, that was very kind of jazzy and more popular music, which is really good because it gets them to think about other things.
Now it's time to hear the senior winner's piece from the Young Composers Competition. It's by Sarah Gate. It's called Portrait of a Moor. We're about to hear its first public performance. Now, Sarah, Portrait of a Moor, there's a picture behind this. Explain where the inspiration came from and what image we ought to have in our heads.
Yes, the inspiration was from a picture by James Northcote. It's actually a portrait of the American actor Ira Aldridge in the title role of Shakespeare's Othello, and it's called Othello, the Moor of Venice. And I was just really intrigued by the look on the subject's face, because it's a really jealous look, and his eyes are raised slightly, and around the edges of the painting it's very murky. Then it comes into focus on the features of his face, and I wanted to reflect that in the piece. So the piece moves from a more murky sound world with a lot of unusual techniques to an intense focus.
And you've taken some of the physical aspects of the picture as well, haven't you? The sort of folds and layers that
That's
you can
right.
see.
That's right, and the colour scheme too. The artist used a very restricted colour scheme, just brown, black and white, shades of that. And I've concentrated the harmonic and melodic writing on just two intervals, the fifth and the semitone, and because they're quite contrasting intervals, and based all the pitch material on that. to make it quite focused too.
Thank you.
Portrait of a Moor by Sarah Gate, taking her inspiration from a 19th century painting of an actor playing Shakespeare's Othello. And it was played there by the Aurora Orchestra, conducted by Nicholas Collin, the senior winner in the Young Composers Competition. I'm backstage at the Royal College of Music with composer Anna Meredith. And Anna, you've been presiding over almost every aspect of this in some way, shape or form. So tell us what your role's been so far.
I've been really lucky to be part of all aspects of the Inspire Day. I've been part of the hubs, where we've taken some workshops out to regions of the UK and introduced the idea of composing to some people who've never maybe composed before. I was also a judge on the competition. And then today, on this amazing day where we're bringing all sorts of aspects together, I've run a workshop, and then I've also here in my capacity as the National Youth Orchestra's composition tutor.
And when you bring these young people, these young composers together like this, it must be quite exciting just seeing the sparks and the light bulbs flashing as people get ideas and realise what's possible.
I think that's what's so great about this day, is the diversity of things that are open to these composers. This is not a restrictive, you must do this, this is how you write for Flute Day, this is a have you ever tried thinking about a big graphic gestures or loop-based music or electronics. These are really sort of door-opening ideas, and I think these young composers are going to go away and hopefully be turned on their heads in terms of the way of thinking.
Now, the ones that are involved with the National Youth Orchestra's composition programme, the NYO Hub, they get a particularly good grounding and opportunity. Describe the way in which that's been happening over their courses.
Yeah, the NYO Creative Hub course runs in parallel to the main orchestral course. So it's really intense, because the orchestra rehearses incredibly hard. We do 2 weeks at Christmas, 2 weeks at Easter, and 2 weeks in the summer in a different place in the UK. So we'll be in residence at a university or a school. And over those 2 weeks, we'll have 7 or 8 teenage composers who essentially are with myself and the other composition tutors, Larry Goves and Chris Mayo, kind of 12 hours a day, you know, listening to music, trying ideas. So it's a very intense environment, but they get to try stuff for the orchestra, they get to write pieces for instruments they've never written for before. So this is the culmination of our kind of year-long programme, and it's been a real kind of honour to work actually with these young composers so much. Got very attached to them, we spend a lot of time together.
And we've been able to hear the results, the compositions themselves by these young composers from the NYO, performed by members of the NYO in a concert this afternoon. So, well, pick one of them for us and introduce it. What was one that you find a particular highlight?
Well, we gave the composers an unusual brief of asking them to invent an Olympic sport and then write some music for it. So we had some really fantastic ideas and approaches, but one that really caught my imagination is from a fantastic young composer called Benjamin Weatherfield, who wrote a piece very evocatively titled Rhythmic Gymnastics with Lions, and he's really managed to capture the precariousness and fear of this rhythmic gymnastics done under this sort of growling tension of the lions underneath.
Thank you. Rhythmic Gymnastics with Lions by Benjamin Weatherfield, one of the seven young composers from the NYO Hub who've been working with Anna Meredith and whose pieces were performed by members of the National Youth Orchestra conducted by Jerry Cornelius in the first concert in this Proms Inspire Day. Now it's time to hear the last of our three winners in the Proms Inspire Young Composers competition. It's the second of the junior winners, Freddie Myers, 15 years old, and this is Three Apparitions for Large Orchestra. Now Freddie's with me. What's behind the title, Freddie? Where are these three apparitions? Where are they from?
Well, I first draw the idea from Scrooge's Christmas Carol, where Scrooge is visited by three ghosts. And this is the same sort of idea, except the ghosts in my piece are of fear, love and death.
And a 12-note row in these three movements as well. Are you a committed serialist, or is this an experiment?
I'm quite happy to experiment with different ideas. I've done minimalist pieces before. I've done, you know, completely tonal pieces. I like to experiment with different sort of ways of composing.
And so we have the same row throughout, but three movements, three different moods as well.
Yes, very. I tried to contrast all the different moods so that there were three different, very separate movements.
Three Apparitions by Freddie Myers, inspired by Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. Freddie's short serialist work in three movements, and he's our second junior winner. It was played there by the Aurora Orchestra, conducted by Nicholas Collin. Now, one of the workshops we've been eavesdropping on at the Royal College of Music this afternoon has been called In Search of New Sonic Expressions, and it's been run by Mike Roberts, who's head of electronic music at the Guildhall School in London, and some of his students. And the idea has been to explore electronic technology and the way it can enrich and expand the sounds available to composers. Now, Grace and Adam are with me from that workshop, both 17-year-olds. And Adam, do you get to play with this kind of technology whenever you want it, or are there things here that are new to you?
Well, in GCSE, when I was in year 10 and year 11, we, for composition, we only used Logic, which was sort of gave me an understanding of electronic music, and I was quite sort of used to it when we did it.
So some of this is very familiar to you, but yeah. What about the kinds of techniques that are being talked about? And I know you've only got a brief time to actually play with it and work together on these things, but they must be coming up with some quite interesting ideas for you.
Yeah, we use sort of plugins. Plugins are sort of, you know, delay, reverb, and how you can expand on that to create a different sound. So we're using just a simple click or something, and then suddenly you can change that into an actual tuning, so you can create a piece of music of just a sound. That's sort of what we were trying to figure.
Now, Grace, when you're writing music of your own, is this the kind of thing that you naturally reach for, or is some of this really new tools as far as you're concerned?
Not generally. Usually I'd use Sibelius and working with real instruments and stuff. But I mean, I'm loving all these ideas that they're giving us about finding sort of new voices, I suppose, and new sounds to work with and just make new tunes and all sorts with. Like, it's really inspiring, actually, just, yeah, being able to create your own instruments with literally sounds, and almost anything that you see you can pick up and make a noise with and create a completely new sound that no one else has ever been able to record like that before.
So you've suddenly got a whole new canvas, a whole new world of possibilities opening up in front of you. That must be, well, it could be quite frightening, actually. Where do you start?
I don't know. They had a few folders where I suppose you could take it down to sort of kitchen noises, where I know they used, like, dragging a spoon down a cooling rack and recording that, and that had sort of reverb after it and all sorts, and stuff like pans and everything. And so I suppose you could put it into sort of groups, like kitchen stuff, nature maybe, like using water and droplets and all sorts like that.
And as somebody who's probably, from the sound of it, more used to using conventional orchestral instruments and the sorts of things that you'd expect in classical music, did you suddenly find yourself thinking, I'm getting excited about all the different kinds of ways I could use these with what I already know?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think it's really great. You can sort of mix them as well. So I'm sure you could find a way of joining in, like, all these different sounds with the orchestral instruments. And, yeah, just creating new combinations. I mean, there's just a world of possibilities. So it's just finding whatever you are inspired by and just create new stuff with it.
Thank you. Some of the sounds emerging from the electronics workshop that's been going on all day, one of the workshops at the Royal College of Music. And we've met some of the students who hopefully have been inspired by everything they've discovered and the encounters they've had today. But there was so much more from the concert that we haven't had time to play you, the runners-up. So the least we thought we could do was to leave you with just a taste of the 10 talented composers whose pieces were performed by the Aurora Orchestra's musicians in the concert. They make a pretty colourful collage.
Thank you. fantastic means dinner will be served at Half Tiger. I tried to throw the ball to Tony, but it won't move if there's still petrol in the safe. Now we've done it.
Collage of some of the highly commended entries in this year's Proms Inspire competition, played by the Aurora Orchestra and singer Miriam Allen, conducted by Nicholas Collin. Featured were extracts of works by Bryony Connor, Daniel Hogan, Christopher Bowman, Toby Hessian, Joshua Hagley, Aditya Chanda, Rob Jones, Frankie Perry, Joss Smith and Samuel Hall. And that survey of Proms Inspire was hosted by Andrew McGregor. Well, the BBC Proms aren't the only live events here on Radio 3 at the moment. Jamie McDougall explains.
3 weeks of music on BBC Radio 3 from the Edinburgh International Festival. Every weekday morning at 11 o'clock, a stellar lineup of musicians, including Sir Thomas Allen, Leifover Adsness, Rebecca Evans, John Williams and John Etheridge, Clay Williams and the Australian Chamber Orchestra. And tomorrow, the violinist Leonidas Kavakos and the brilliant Russian pianist Nikolai Lugansky team up to bring us a recital of sonatas by Janáček, Brahms, Stravinsky and Respighi. Our week from Edinburgh continues live tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock on BBC Radio 3.
And if you missed Sir Thomas Allen earlier in the week, or Trio Zimmermann, for example, in fact, any of the Edinburgh relays, just a reminder of listen again, the iPlayer, in high-definition sound, that's via the Radio 3 homepage. It's a quarter to 11 and time now for the last of three essay programmes we're repeating this week, devoted to different aspects of Percy Grainger, the Australian-born composer and pianist who died in 1961. Tonight, the pianist Lucy Parham looks at Grainger, the pianist, and begins with one of Grainger's own recordings.
Unmistakable celebratory sounds of Edvard Grieg's Wedding Day at Trollhaugen, played by the Australian-born pianist and composer Percy Grainger in a recording made in 1921. And that piece takes me back to the recital I gave at the Bergen Festival in Norway recently, when I was playing at the New Hall at Trollhaugen. It's attached to Grieg's house, which is now a museum nestling in the heart of the Norwegian countryside. After the concert, I was offered the chance to play on Grieg's Steinway piano, which sits in the middle of his very homely sitting room with its panoramic views of the Norwegian fjords. What was special for me was that this was the same piano that Grainger would have played when he visited Grieg at this very house during the summer of 1907. Looking at the picture of the two composers sitting side by side, I realise it captured a fleeting moment of a relationship that was to be sadly short-lived. Percy Grainger and Grieg first met in London the previous year and had corresponded regularly since then. When they met, Grieg was astonished to learn that Grainger had his Norwegian folk songs and peasant dances in his repertoire. He was ecstatic with Grainger's interpretations of these works, especially as they'd not received a particularly glowing reception when they were first published. And so, the following year, in 1907, Grieg invited the young Grainger to his home in Bergen. Grainger was due to perform Grieg's piano concerto at the Leeds Festival, and during his visit to Norway, the two musicians spent many hours working and revising the piece together. Grieg declared that he had to wait until he was 64 years old to hear Norwegian piano music interpreted so understandingly and brilliantly. In fact, he was so impressed with Grainger that he wrote to all the influential newspapers and critics about the young pianist. Grieg truly believed that Grainger was the next Anton Rubinstein, the great Russian pianist and pedagogue, and because of this, he set about trying to further his career in Europe. After the very intense time the two musicians spent together, it was a great loss for Grainger when Grieg died just a few months later, tragically thwarting their brief, though mutually rewarding, relationship. In 1921, Grainger recorded Grieg's concerto on piano roll, and there are also four recordings of him performing the work live. In fact, Grieg's piano works remained very close to Grainger's heart throughout his life, with him performing them all over the world and even editing a special edition of the concerto. But how had the young Australian musician developed into the extraordinarily talented pianist that so captivated Edvard Grieg over 100 years ago? Percy Grainger was born into a middle-class home in Melbourne, but his parents separated when he was only 8. His mother, Rose, paid huge attention to nurturing his artistic abilities in writing, history and the arts, and she herself was, as Percy later described, the strongest influence on his artistic life. Her love of poetry and the arts were always evident, and Grainger acknowledged that he never failed to get support, criticism and instinctive insight from his mother. Rose was a keen pianist herself, and when Percy was just 5, she began teaching him the piano. He later remembered what he called the rhythmic robustness of her piano playing and how her saucy and almost naive gracefulness endowed her playing with an irresistibly winsome lilt. Having felt her young son was outgrowing her lessons, the ambitious Rose Granger set about finding him a better teacher. In Louis Pabst, she discovered a teacher who'd studied with Anton Rubinstein and someone who'd educate her son in the much-lauded Russian school of piano playing. It was through Pabst that Granger became obsessed with the music of Bach, the passion that never left him throughout his performing life. And it was with Bach, his B-flat partita, that the 12-year-old made his public debut in 1894. He despised what he called the sewing machine way of playing Bach, preferring to play it in a more romantic style, using lots of rubato and a more idiosyncratic style of interpretation. But Pabst wanted to return to Europe, and because he wasn't keen on Granger pursuing his love of composition, the two parted company. But ironically, they were to remain geographically close. Spurred on by the critical success of his debut and with the occasional financial support of his father, Percy and his highly ambitious mother made the long and arduous journey to Frankfurt. It was here Percy became a student of both the piano and of composition at the Hoch Conservatorium, which was then one of Europe's leading music schools. In fact, the legendary Clara Schumann had been head of piano here just a few years previously. During the next few years, Rose taught English and music to earn enough money to support them both, and at the tender age of only 14, Percy was being hailed as a prodigy in Germany. Although he later wrote that he learnt very little from his new teacher, he did gain some invaluable musical experiences at this time. Being exposed to many other performers, some of legendary status, his attitude to performing was transformed. When, for example, he heard Eugen Dalbert, a legendary pupil of Franz Liszt, his experience proved electrifying. At this time, Granger's mother became increasingly unwell, and he decided to make London their base. Settling into the city, the connections that Granger built up in London society quickly enabled him to build up his public following and find patronage from some of the wealthy elite. Having played at Steinway Hall, he was presented to royalty and commanded to play at Buckingham Palace, with his colonial affiliations proving a useful way of finding performance opportunities in high society. He received numerous invitations to play in fashionable salons, which he loathed, but he desperately needed the money. Granger's choice of repertoire was always controversial. He never played Mozart, Haydn, or Beethoven, bizarrely believing Beethoven to be a frivolous composer. But Bach always featured prominently, alongside his own and others' transcriptions of Bach's works. Granger loved playing the big romantic giants like Chopin, Schumann and Brahms, although he wasn't too complimentary about Brahms the man, referring to him as the composer who had a delicate and tender heart but was well encased in sausages. And if I find that statement a bit hard to swallow, I only need to listen to Granger's recordings to be reminded of just what a truly great pianist he was. I first heard his 1927 recording of Schumann's G minor sonata some years ago when I was studying the work myself. And what becomes immediately apparent is that the mind of the composer at work is always foremost. Where many pianists play this piece so fast you can barely recognise it, Granger has paid attention to every detail, really trying to get into Schumann's very complex mind. For him, tempo seems to be a means to an end. In fact, he used to tell his students that tempo marking should never be taken too literally, and that each performer would find their own voice through discovering their own tempo. He stressed that the most important thing should always be the music, and what lay at the heart of the piece was what counted the most. During his long and exhausting tours of South Africa, Australia and England, Granger also championed the then unfamiliar works of Ravel, Albéniz and Debussy. And his own compositions were a tremendous success with the public too, many of them virtuosic transcriptions and arrangements, with the most famous being the ever-hummable Country Gardens. The popularity of Grainger's works was spreading quickly, and it's only when you listen to his transcriptions and original compositions for the piano that you realise his true stature as a composer-pianist. Grainger's friendships with other composers of that time, like Cyril Scott, Charles Villiers Stanford and Roger Quilter, resulted in many of their own pieces being transcribed or dished up, as he liked to call it. Grainger transformed a bewildering amount of material and touched it with a golden hand of genius to make it truly unique. Here is a pianist that seemed to have no difficulty in covering the keys, gliding and weaving around the most ferociously challenging pieces. He called some of his works free rambles, and you can see why, as his unique improvisatory style is always at the forefront of these compositions. When you listen to his paraphrase of Tchaikovsky's famous Waltz of the Flowers from The Nutcracker, it's truly staggering how Grainger manages to fit several layers of the orchestration into two hands and then improvise over the top of that. It's a technical feat that just leaves you speechless, and the highly florid cadenza at the end would have had people clamouring for more. But in spite of that, you never get the sense that the music gets lost amid the virtuosity. Grainger seemed to have developed a love-hate relationship with the piano, which prevailed throughout his life. I love the fact that he once declared that he loathed the piano because he considered it an affront to destroy a melodiously conceived idea by trying to fit it into what he called the limitations of two hands and a box full of hammers and strings. Not that that was Grainger's only controversial view on playing the piano. It seems that many of his attitudes to playing the piano would cause a few raised eyebrows. For example, he believed scales were a waste of time and that you should always find your practice material from within the pieces you were studying at that time. Actually, I think there's a lot of sense in that, but I doubt whether that was something that his teachers would have encouraged. The complex technique of pedalling and all its permutations of half-pedalling, flutter-pedalling and sostenuto-pedalling were also things he continuously stressed. And rather ahead of his time, Grainger was devoted to physical fitness, almost verging on an obsession, which is something I think you can hear with the abundance of energy that typifies his piano playing. He never walked where he could run somewhere, and he kept a chinning bar in his sitting room, which he used every day. When Grainger moved to America in 1914 with his by now very ailing mother, he even managed to eclipse the huge pianistic success he'd achieved in Europe. The Americans adored him, and through his sold-out concerts, he became one of the most sought-after performers of the time. Pieces like Country Gardens and Handel in the Strand became highly successful and popular there too, with sheet music sales breaking many publishing records. And they'd often be the pieces that the public were clamouring to hear at the end of his long recitals. Although by now he'd become an American citizen, when his mother committed suicide, the devastated Grainger sought solace in his work and returned to Europe for a year. Performing was always to remain integral to his life. Percy Grainger's thinking is often referred to as different or eccentric. There are numerous stories of his antics and outlandish performance habits, such as bounding down the central aisle of a concert hall during the opening drum roll of the Grieg Concerto and somersaulting onto the stage just in time to play the opening piano chords. But at heart, I think Grainger always felt he was a composer rather than a pianist and wanted posterity to remember him like that. He was part of that elite group of composer-pianists, joining the likes of Liszt, Busoni, Godofsky and Rachmaninoff. But ironically, without his highly developed understanding of the piano, Grainger could never have composed the masterpieces he did. He His knowledge of the instrument was always central to his compositions, with all of them being very pianist-friendly for the performer. Sadly, he seemed to regard his career as a virtuoso pianist with distaste. But the public didn't agree, and Granger leaves a performance and recording legacy that's just as strong as his compositions. And for that, we, as performers and listeners, should be extremely grateful.
Lucy Parham, ending this week's series of programmes about Percy Granger. For the essay, Aspects of Granger, is a Potten Hall production for BBC Radio 3. The producer was Jeremy Hayes, and the programmes were first broadcast in September last year. In an hour and a half tonight, Radio 3 Through the Night sets off with a recent concert from Romania, the George Enescu Philharmonic, in Beethoven's First Symphony and the Romanian Concerto by the Hungarian George Ligeti. That's quite a rarity. 12:30, starting time for that. BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM on digital radio and online. It's 11 o'clock. And now Late Junction with Verity Sharp.
L'amore mio non può disperdersi nel vento con le rose, tanto è forte che non cederà, non sfiorirà. Io lo veglierò, io lo difenderò da tutte quelle insidie velenose che vorrebbero strapparlo al cuore, povero amore. Forse te ne andrai da altri amori, le carezze cercherai, ahimè. E se tornerai già sfiorita, la passione troverai. L'amore no, l'amore mio non può dissolversi con l'oro dei capelli. Finché io vivo, sarà vivo in me, solo per te. Con l'oro dei capelli, finché io vivo, sarà vivo in me, solo per te.
Anyone who's anyone has recorded that song over the years. Marlo Moreno, Everything But Love, as sung there by Orchestra Coco on their debut album. Welcome to Late Junction. Here are the Hot Seats with the Mineola Rag.